Cheers.
Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you today. For the Education Report, Dr. Jill Robbins and Gregory Stockel explain how to write a good email. Susan Shand reports on the cruise industry and their terrible year in 2020. I will return with this week's words and their stories. We will finish our 30 minutes together with The Making of a Nation, our ongoing U.S. history program. But first, the Education Report.
Email is one of the most important ways through which we communicate. It has become part of most everyone's day-to-day life. Writing a good email can mean the difference between someone reading it and writing back and someone ignoring it altogether. Do you have questions on how to make your message more effective? Today on Education Tips, we will answer the question, how can I make my emails better? Emails are made up of four different parts:
the subject line, the opening, the body, and the closing.
Let us explore how to make each of these parts better.
The subject line is what the other person or receiver will read first. The subject line is usually the most important part of an email. It should be short, but contain enough details that the receiver recognizes the subject of the email. A good subject line sets the expectations for the email. A bad subject line can mean the receiver will not read the email. Some people will add the word important to the subject line, but this does not provide enough information. Instead of writing important, two better choices for subject lines are:
meeting tomorrow at 10 a.m. to discuss new changes. Question about future classes. As in any form of writing, you should know your audience. The opening of an email depends on things like how formal the relationship is. If you are sending an email to a friend or someone you work with, two good openings or greetings are:
good morning, good afternoon, hello, or hello and the person's name.
If you are sending the email to someone you do not know and it is a formal situation, some possible openings are:
dear, name of department, to whom it may concern.
In a formal situation, when you know the name of the person, a good opening is simply:
dear, title, family name, as in, dear Mr. Brown. The body of the email is where you ask for what you need, or make clear your reason for writing the email. This could be asking them a question or keeping them informed. The body of the email should prioritize the most important information. It should be direct, and it is wise to keep it short. If the person you are emailing does not know you, you should introduce yourself in the first few lines. You might write,
"My name is Patricia Jones. I am sending this email to get some more information about the job you advertised." After you have introduced yourself and given your reason for writing, you can follow this with the body of your email. The most important information should come first. This makes your email clear to your receiver and saves them time. Here is an example.
I wanted to know if you are currently accepting applications. If so, where can I send my information? Additionally, will you be meeting people in person or online?
It is important to clearly explain yourself in as few words as possible. Try to keep your email short but polite. This is important because you want to make yourself clear to your receiver.
The last part to a good email is the closing. It is usually one or two words that let the receiver know that this is the end of the email. The ending should include your name and tell the receiver where you work and what you do. A few different closings are:
kind regards, best, thank you.
Some applications create an automatic signature for the sender. This is useful because it saves time when you are writing.
If you follow these suggestions, you will find that you receive more responses to your emails. Effective email writing is important, especially now when so much of what we do is online. I'm Gregory Stockel.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
Our next story is from Susan Shand.
The vacation cruise industry has accepted it cannot restart operations this year. Major cruise lines Carnival and Norwegian recently extended a halt on cruises through the end of the year. Then, the cruise industry representative group said Tuesday that its members have agreed they would not sail for the rest of 2020. The announcement comes just days after the U.S. government effectively lifted its no-sail order, even though there is a worldwide increase in coronavirus infections. Cruise Lines International Association represents 95% of cruise lines, including Princess, Carnival, and Royal Caribbean. It said its members have voluntarily decided to shut down cruise operations in the U.S. through the end of the year. Members will use the remainder of the year to prepare for extensive measures to address COVID-19 safety, with the guidance of public health experts and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the association said. On Friday, federal health officials announced new rules permitting large cruise ships to start sailing again in U.S. waters, but not immediately. The CDC will require that ship owners must test all passengers and crew at the start and end of each cruise. Only 7-day cruises will be permitted. In March, the CDC ordered cruise ships to stop sailing to the U.S. after several outbreaks showed officials that the ships were spreading COVID-19 infection. The announcement last week brings the no-sail order to an end. The cruise industry closed for business in the middle of March because of the virus. The cruise industry estimates the economy lost $25 billion in economic activity and about 164 American jobs. The CDC's new rules say that in order to start carrying passengers, the companies must show they can test and quarantine anyone who gets the virus. Among other requirements, they will have to build testing laboratories on all ships and make their own plans to isolate or quarantine passengers at ports if needed. I'm Susan Shand.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Wind is a powerful force in nature. High wind speeds from tornadoes, hurricanes, and other violent storms can cause great destruction. But wind can also be a force for good. It can turn machinery that produces energy. It can help boats sail great distances. In the wild, wind can provide life-saving information to some animals. And it doesn't need to be a strong wind. For example, a scent or smell carried by a light breeze can tell a deer about the presence of a hunter just a few meters away. The wind can provide useful information to people, too. When we get wind of something, we hear some news or information that has been kept private. Naturally, this air of secrecy makes it even more interesting. When using this expression, remember this: when we get wind of something, we become aware of the information through indirect means. In other words, we learn of it secondhand or through the grapevine. We do not hear it straight from the source. The wind might give others information that we want to keep quiet. For example, the leaders of the company were worried about investors getting wind of the factory fire. If the investors knew, they would probably withdraw their money and invest elsewhere. Here is another example. The filmmakers did not want the media to get wind of the actor's latest arrest. After all, she is playing a police officer in the movie. At times, the information or news sent by the wind is bad, just gossip or talk, and not really helpful at all. For example, if someone asks me, "Did you hear that so-and-so lost his job?" I can answer, "Yeah, I got wind of that yesterday." But sometimes the news or information is not bad. It is just something you want to keep secret. Like the time I tried to plan a surprise party for my best friend. I did not want him to get wind of it. That would ruin the surprise. But it is so difficult keeping anything from him. He is nosy and asks a lot of questions, such as, why are you calling all my friends? Why are you buying so much food and drinks? Are you planning a party for me? So much for that surprise party. Now, this expression is not always about learning private information or keeping secrets. The wind can send us information that we need to make good decisions. For example, I was just about to buy tickets to a big 3-day outdoor music event. But then I got wind that my favorite performer, and the only reason I was going, had canceled. Thank goodness a friend of a friend of a friend told me, or I would not have known. And that is all the time we have for this Words and Their Stories. I will have a new story for you next week. But if I get wind of a change in plans, I'll make sure to let you know. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo. Listen to the wind blow. Where does the wind go? What does the wind know? Listen to the wind blow. Listen to the wind blow. Listen to the wind blow.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In July of 1861, Union soldiers from the North and Confederate soldiers from the South fought the first major battle in the American Civil War. They clashed at Manassas, or Bull Run, Virginia, less than 50 kilometers from Washington. The Union soldiers fought fiercely, but two large Confederate forces broke the Union attack. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell about some of the other early battles of the Civil War.
Northerners had expected to win the Battle of Bull Run. They believed the Confederacy would fall if the Union won a big military victory early in the war. Now, however, there was great fear that Southern soldiers would seize Washington. The Union needed to build and train an army quickly. President Abraham Lincoln named General George McClellan to do this. McClellan was 34 years old. The young general had two important tasks. He must defend Washington from attack, and he must build an army to strike at enemy forces in Virginia. McClellan wasted no time. He put thousands of troops into position around the city, and he built 48 forts. After this rush of activity, however, little more happened for a long time. McClellan told his wife, "I shall take my own time to make an army that will be sure of success. As soon as I feel my army is well organized and well trained and strong enough, I will force the rebels to a battle." McClellan kept making excuses for why he would not move against the enemy. His excuses became a continuing source of trouble for President Lincoln. The public, the press, and politicians all demanded that McClellan do something. They wanted to win the war, and win it right away.
McClellan commanded the biggest army in the Union, the Army of the Potomac. But it was not the only army. Others were battling Confederate forces in the West. The Confederates had moved up through Tennessee into the border state of Kentucky. They built forts and other defensive positions across the southern part of the state. They also blocked as many railroads and rivers as they could. Their job was to keep Union forces from invading the South through Kentucky. One of the Union generals in the area was Ulysses Grant. Grant had served in the Army for 20 years. He had fought in America's war against Mexico and had won honors for his bravery. When that war ended, he was sent to an Army base far from his wife and children. He did not like being without them, and he did not like being an officer in peacetime. Grant began to drink too much alcohol. He began to be a problem. In 1854, he was asked to leave the army. When the Civil War started, Grant organized a group of unpaid soldiers in Illinois. With the help of a member of Congress, he was named a general. All of the other Union generals knew Ulysses Grant. Few had any faith in his abilities. They were sure he would always fail.
Grant, however, had faith in himself and his men. He believed he could force Confederate soldiers to withdraw from both Kentucky and Tennessee. Then he would be free to march directly into the Deep South, Mississippi. Two Confederate forts stood in Grant's way. They were in Tennessee, close to the Kentucky border. United States Navy gunboats captured the first, Fort Henry, on the Tennessee River. That fort was easy to attack and not well defended. The fighting was over by the time Grant and his men got there. The second, Fort Donelson, was nearby on the Cumberland River. It was stronger and defended by 20,000 soldiers. Grant surrounded the fort and let the Navy gunboats shell it. The fighting there lasted several days.
At one point, the Confederates tried to break out of the fort and escape. They opened a hole in the Union line and began to retreat. Suddenly, however, their commanding officer decided it would be wrong to retreat. He ordered them back to the fort. After that, there was no choice. The Confederates would have to surrender. The commanding officer sent a message to General Grant. What were the terms of surrender? Grant's answer was simple. No terms except unconditional and immediate surrender. The Confederates gave up Fort Donelson. Grant took 14,000 prisoners. It was the greatest Union victory since the start of the war. Ulysses Grant was a hero. Newspapers called him Unconditional Surrender Grant.
After the Union victory at Fort Donelson, Confederate forces withdrew from Tennessee. They moved farther south and began to regroup at Corinth, Mississippi. Confederate generals hoped to build one big army to stop Ulysses Grant. They would have to move fast. Grant was marching toward Corinth with 40,000 men. Another 35,000, under the command of Don Buell, were to meet him on the way. Grant arrived in the area first. He waited for Buell 30 kilometers from Corinth, near a small country meeting hall called Shiloh Church. Confederate General Albert Sidney Johnston was waiting, too. He had more than 40,000 men, about the same as Grant, and he was expecting another 20,000. But when he learned that Grant was nearby, he decided not to wait. He would attack immediately.
Johnston did not know it, but his attack came as a surprise to the Union Army. Union officers had refused to believe reports that Johnston was on the move. They said his army was not strong enough to attack. Union troops did not prepare defensive positions. They had no protection when the battle began. The fighting at Shiloh was the bitterest of the war. It was not one battle, but many. Groups of men fought each other all across the wide battlefield. From a distance, they shot at each other. Close up, they cut each other with knives. The earth became red with blood. The dead and wounded soon lay everywhere. At first, the Confederates pushed Grant's army back. They had only to break through one more line, and victory would be theirs. But in the thick of the struggle, General Johnston was shot in the leg. The bullet cut through an artery. Johnston bled to death before help arrived. Any hope for a Southern victory at Shiloh died with him. By the time the fighting began again the next day, General Buell had arrived to help Grant. The Confederate Army retreated. The Union Army let it go.
Shiloh. The word itself came to mean death and destruction. The Battle of Shiloh had brought home to the American people, both of the North and South, the horror of war. It was the first time so many men, 100,000, had fought against each other in the Western world. It was the American people's first real taste of the bloodiness of modern warfare. As one soldier who fought there said, "It was too shocking, too horrible. I hope to God that I may never see such things again." The North won the Battle of Shiloh, but it paid a very high price for victory. More than 13,000 Union soldiers were killed, wounded, or missing. On the Confederate side, more than 10,000 soldiers were killed or wounded. The North celebrated the news of its victory. But joy quickly turned to anger when the public learned of the heavy losses. People blamed General Grant. They demanded that President Lincoln dismiss him. Lincoln thought of the two men who were now his top military commanders, McClellan and Grant. They were so different. McClellan organized an army and then did nothing. Grant organized an army and moved. Lincoln said of Grant, "I cannot do without this man. He fights."
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Anna Mateo.